I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. I'm Kevin Middleton, and I'm here today to speak with Mary Sarah Stanton, and she's a holistic health coach. And we want to talk about what a holistic health coach is and does, and really how having this kind of support can just make all the difference for you and your family to live a vital and thriving life. And we want to talk a little bit about Mary Sarah's journey to become a health coach, and so we'll get into depth with that. Now, first I want to tell you a little bit about Mary Sarah. Many of you know about Father Christopher Stanton, and Mary Sarah is his wife. And we've had Father Christopher on our show a few times, and really appreciate the work that both are doing to support our communities. Mary Sarah Stanton is a holistic health coach, certified childbirth educator, and a mother of six. Her interest in health and nutrition has been a lifelong pursuit. Starting a pre-nursing degree in college, Mary Sarah has changed her course with the birth of her first child towards natural birth and the health of mother and baby. Becoming involved in the Leche League and having taken WIC's peer counseling training program to support nursing mothers, Mary Sarah worked to promote and advocate for healthy mother-baby relationships and growth through breastfeeding. Seeing a need for a more general approach to health and well-being, Mary Sarah enrolled in the Institute for Integrative Nutrition Program to be able to reach a broader audience and to see a community need met through providing an alternative and comprehensive nutritional health program for the public. Becoming a holistic health coach, Mary Sarah provides the information and support necessary for all who are interested in or need of a change of health to become successful through better nutrition and lifestyle improvements. She does this through community workshops and individual consultation programs. Mary Sarah is excited to be a part of the healing community, nurturing lives through better nutrition, and we're really excited to have you in the community doing just that. You know, and I have to tell you, I mean, in our work in the acupuncture center, it is always, always, always a topic that comes up with, you know, there are changes that clearly need to be made, but it's very hard to know where to start for folks. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about your journey, and we'll take it from there.
Well, it's also a lifelong journey. I have to thank my folks for growing me up, or raising me, I guess, in a very natural way. We ate whole wheat bread and lived on a farm, and they had a vision of kind of being a self-sufficient, you know, horse-drawn machinery farm back in the 70s, Christian farm. And so it started there with a garden and baking our own bread and buying from food co-ops. And so kind of, you know, different way of eating, and a good way of eating has always been part of my life. And as I grew up and went to college, I kind of veered away from that and didn't eat so good for a few years and pretty quickly decided that wasn't such a good idea. And so then again, as I started to have a family, that kind of journey kind of came back to better eating, and then, like you said, a real interest in breastfeeding. That's just so important to the beginning for a baby's life, you know, for the foundation of good nutrition there. Just kind of, you know, one thing led to another. Pre-nursing degree, I took some nutrition classes, but they were very mainstream classes and weren't that interesting. You know, it was kind of the government line on nutrition, I guess.
We should come back to that too, just to contrast what the government protocol for good eating is and what you've discovered through the Institute of Integrative Nutrition.
Did my La Leche League time with that, which is a breastfeeding support group for mothers, and spent several years involved there, working with the leaders and leading those groups and supporting other moms. And kind of got into that because people kept asking me about, you know, questions they had with breastfeeding. And I had had pretty easy time with my children, and so I wasn't real sure how to answer them. And so I went, okay, I need to find this out. And so that's what got me involved there. And then the same thing with WIC. I took the training. There were no positions available at the time, so I wound up not actually being able to become a actual peer counselor for WIC. But very good training on how to help moms be successful in that process. And then last spring, my husband goes over. He says, "Hey, look at this ad for this nutrition school. This looks really interesting." So took a look at it and decided it was time to go on to do something more. And that I always have had an interest in nutrition, talking to people about it. Every kind of my discovery along the way, I've had a number of health issues. And discovered that the root cause of those was I have gluten sensitivity. So about 3 years ago, began that journey of not eating gluten anymore. And have had a lot of support through my naturopaths and acupuncturist and chiropractor in that journey. So as I've learned and grown and experienced, then all of my friends and family, I talk with them about it. It's like everywhere we go to visit, we sit down at the table, and what comes up is nutrition. we go back home to Tennessee, and we sit down at, your childhood friend's table, and we talk about what they're eating and what we're eating and how that works or doesn't work and what's good for us and what's not good for us.
Yeah, food is such a central part of people's lives, and it's a pretty emotional part of people's lives too. And so there's so much tied in with what we eat, what we buy to eat, and how we eat. And maybe we can even start there, as just to take a look at that. And what is the Institute of Integrative Nutrition? And maybe you can lead in with that, and then what you've learned about nutrition from that program.
The Institute for Integrative Nutrition is one, if not the largest nutrition school in the world. It's a worldwide distance learning program based out of New York City, founded by Joshua Rosenthal about 25 years ago. And what he looks at is that nutrition is about so much more than just the food we eat. So it's a very broad education of primary foods, which is relationship and career and exercise and spirituality and food, and that all of those things are very important to a healthy life. And you can be eating the best food in the world, but if you have a horrible relationship with your spouse or mother or sister, you're not going to be a very healthy person or a very happy person. And so in being trained as a health coach, we are trained to look at all of those areas of life and how they all interplay with each other, and to help people guide them to eating real food, and then to improve those areas of their lives that they're having struggles in.
And maybe when you say real food, can you say more about what that is?
Real food is food that isn't processed or packaged, or so it looks the way it does when it comes off the tree, out of the ground, from the animal. An apple, a carrot, a cut of meat, milk that hasn't been heated. So it is food in its natural state, and hasn't been altered or processed.
And what is the real leap there for people to come back to real food?
Oh, well, kind of probably the drive behind it would be the way they feel with what they're eating now. So it can be, we like the foods we eat often, but a lot of the foods we eat today make us sick. And so as a person begins to realize that something's got to change, I have type 2 diabetes, I'm way overweight, I have headaches all the time, all of these many, many, many ways that our body tells us, hey, whoa, stop, something's not right here.
Right.
That as they begin to look at those things, then they go, okay, how do I make that change? And so it's just a gradual process, a step-by-step process. And this is where the health coach really comes in, is to really help kind of support and guide that process of, okay, let's start by, you just need to drink more water. If we're drinking 5 cans of soda a day and a glass of water, that's the first place to start right there.
Now, when people say, well, there's water and soda, what do you say about that?
Well, unfortunately, yes, there is water and soda, but the carbonated water and the caffeine are both diuretics. And so actually, when you drink a soda, not only do you not benefit from the water you're taking in, it takes the water that's already in your body out with it. So it's a double negative. And that's just one part of the whole soda issue. It's only the tip of the iceberg.
Well, I mean, diet sodas and sodas are so much a part of people's lifestyle, mm-hmm. and even an emotional attachment there. So what other things that people need to know about sodas while we're on the topic?
Well, that anytime we're taking in a liquid sugar, that's like the worst way possible to have sugars in our body, because it increases that glycemic spike. You know, more, you get a lot more sugar per measure of food or liquid when it's in liquid form.
So it's really hitting your blood sugar, and it spikes it right up. And that accounts for the real lift.
Mm-hmm. Right, the immediate lift, right? You feel great, and then you start to be tired after a couple hours, and then you drink another one. Yeah.
How does that work with artificially sweetened sodas? How's that affecting the physiology?
Well, there's some concern that actually some of those artificial sweeteners actually they may not cause the glycemic spike that a sugar does, but the body still thinks it's sugar. So it doesn't cause a glycemic spike, but you still create the insulin response.
Oh.
So it still puts you on the insulin roller coaster problem.
Interesting.
So, and I don't know if that's true of all of them, but I know some of them can cause that.
Right, and that's not even addressing the harmful effects of artificial sweeteners.
Exactly.
And inflammatory effects.
Inflammatory effects, carcinogenic effects. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Now, when really working with people,
mm-hmm.
oftentimes we'll hear, you know, I know what to do, but I don't do it.
Yes.
How do you respond to that?
Well, that's very true. You know, many of us know what to do or know that we need to do something and we know what we need to eat, but it's just hard to make that change. I know I need to get off gluten, but how do I cook without flour? How do I cook without pasta? How do I cook, you know? And so what I do is I help people gradually make that change. You know, okay, here are some recipes. Here are some simple ways to begin to transition from using wheat flour to using a gluten-free flour.
You know? So maybe some recipes, some food things that they really like and
mm-hmm.
enjoy, and you show them how to make it without gluten, and it actually tastes really good,
yep.
and you feel better afterwards.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, same thing with ways to incorporate more vegetables into our diet, you know, to help them make that gradual process. I know I need to eat more veggies, but my kids won't eat them. Well, let's try fixing them this way. You know, maybe they'll eat them, you know, nicely steamed with some butter and salt, you know, or if they're fresh, you know, or if they go with you to the farmer's market to get them and things like that. So help people see the options that are out there.
How do kids come to not like vegetables? I'm just curious about that. Is that something that is really learned from the parents, or is that something that just there's some obstacle for kids and veggies? I don't understand that.
There's a number of factors and that go into that. So the first thing is from birth, if a child is breastfed, the breast milk flavor changes with what the mom's eating. So they're introduced to a variety of flavors and nutrient experiences through being breastfed. If they're formula fed, it always tastes exactly the same. It always has a high sugar content. And it's very bland in one sense, right? There's no variation. And so if you've had a child who's only eaten one flavor for 6 months or a year, mm-hmm. then adding new strong flavors, less sweet flavors, all of that is going to be more difficult for them. So that's the one aspect. The other is certainly the home environment. You know, if mom and dad aren't eating vegetables, the kids aren't going to eat vegetables. You know, kids will eat what their family's eating. You know, if you start with them when they're young, you know, so if they're learning to eat at 2 and 3 and they're eating, they will eat what their
right.
parents were eating, much more likely. And not to force them, you know. Introduce a new dish. It usually takes 3 to 5 times of serving something for a child to begin to kind of acclimate to that new taste. And so don't force them to eat the whole plate the first time.
Oh, okay.
Ask them to eat 2 bites, you know, or 3 bites, you know, and this kind of just slowly, you know, introduce them. So those are some of the reasons. If they've not eaten vegetables, you know, if they've grown up eating mac and cheese and peanut butter and jelly and, you know, Wendy's and, you know, all of these other foods, and they just haven't eaten vegetables, it's a foreign food to them.
Yeah, because what you're describing there are mostly fat
mm-hmm.
and salt, and so there's
right.
a certain intensity and around, you know, there's some kind of fullness of flavor that comes with that, you know, that's, you know, fast foods are banking on that,
right.
And it develops a kind of addiction cycle. Mac and cheese, you've got salt and butter and,
right.
and cheese, yeah. And then to, I could imagine then vegetables would be comparatively bleak, you know,
yep.
unless they're prepared in the way you're describing.
Well, and that's the thing. And then often we wind up giving them, you know, canned vegetables, which are the least flavorful way of doing it. And they're really salty, but not with the fat to balance it. And so that just tastes salty. And so, unfortunately, you know, because they can be the most, well, I don't know if they're really the most cost effective, but that's what people often buy them that way, because they don't spoil. And so if they don't use them, they don't wind up going bad. Or they buy frozen next, which is better than canned. But again, you know, they're not as fresh, they're not as flavorful. And they often wind up cooking kind of mushy and stuff like that. And so they're not having a lot of fresh cut up, you know, carrot strips or apple slices, or, you know, that's, you know, fresh and local. And
so in the wintertime in Alaska, when the choices are pretty thin, mm-hmm. would you, so frozen is always going to be better than canned.
Mm-hmm.
And is there any circumstance where you would endorse canned vegetables?
It's better than no vegetable. So, yeah, I mean, if that's all you can afford, if that's all you can get, then it's better than no vegetables at all.
Okay.
And, you know, it's better to look for the lower salt versions. If they have a no salt added version or things like that, that's better. But yeah, you know, if that's all you can do, then yeah, get the canned vegetable. It's still a vegetable. You know, it still has some of the nutrients that we need so desperately.
Okay. Yeah. And then how important is it to buy organic, in your opinion?
Well,
vegetables or fruits, and,
right.
and where, you know, which ones are important to buy organic? Are there some that are not, you know, in your experience?
Right. Yeah, there definitely are some that are really important. So all organic is good, because if we're buying all organic, then we're not getting the pesticides, we're not getting the chemical fertilizers, residues that come in those fruits and vegetables. And we're supporting a sustainable way of agriculture, you know, wherever those are coming from. We're not, you know, at the same time, it protects the earth, it protects the water, you know, from the damages of commercial farming. Probably the most important thing to get organic, or even better, grass-fed, is anything that's fat. So meat, butter, milk, those types of things, because most of the toxins are held in the fats. So anything that's high fat is... That's the number one place to start.
So the impurities are concentrated.
Yeah.
So buying milk, you definitely want to buy organic. You're saying that's...
Well, definitely organic or grass-fed raw. And so grass-fed is the best, because then it's not, you know, no grains or anything. It's the healthiest milk, is from a cow that's totally on grass.
Are there networks in the area for local grass-fed milk, as you know about? Or?
I don't know if there's a website. I do know the names of a couple people that sell cow shares for local raw milk.
Okay, and they could contact you to mm-hmm. follow up with that. So
yeah,
we'll give the contact information.
Yeah.
For Zen.
So those are really important, that you look at it being, you know, grass-fed and organic when you're fats. And then in your vegetables, there are 12 that are considered the very worst with pesticides, and I don't remember all of them, but apples, oranges,
I think celery was one of them, if I remember right. It's like 90 different chemicals.
It might be celery, lettuces, sweet peppers. Are some of those. I don't remember all of them right off the top of my head. But those are very, very heavy. So in a sense, the ones that get the pesticide sprayed onto the fruit and we eat it, we don't peel it. Although apparently in the oranges, it gets through the skin.
Yeah, that's what I understand. It's like one of the most heavily pesticided crops there is, with the citrus.
Yeah. And potatoes. Potatoes are one of the worst. Now, I don't know about in Alaska. I've heard somewhere, and maybe you know, that we can't use pesticides on our produce up here. Do you know if that's true or not?
I don't know.
Okay.
No, I don't.
Yeah, I'd heard somewhere in the back of my mind, but I don't know for sure. But potatoes the worst.
I think strawberries are probably another one of those. Yeah.
Strawberries are very high. Peaches, cherries, grapes, imported grapes. Yeah.
You know, this is a really odd symptom, but when I eat grapes, if they're not organic, mm-hmm. like, you know, they're coming from Chile or something like that, but my toes will go numb.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I mean, absolutely 100% correlative. I eat those grapes, my toes will go numb.
Fascinating.
And it lasts for a good, I don't know, probably 12 hours.
Okay. So definitely something they're using in that in those countries that your body really doesn't like.
And that's just a symptom that I notice, mm-hmm. and so it makes me really wonder about other foods that are there's pesticides that are maybe more subtle, uh-huh. but maybe even more damaging effects on the body that go unnoticed over time.
Right, right. And there's many of those, and it's what we call silent inflammation, that we eat these foods that slowly build an inflammation response in the body, but there's no pain, there's no symptoms. And then gradually we just get really, really tired, or we begin to gain a lot of weight, or, at the extreme end, then we begin to actually feel the pain and discomfort of it. But that's, we're already really, really far gone.
Yeah, and along with that, I can't tell you how many people we see who have pain conditions that are made way worse by their diet. And mm-hmm. nobody would ever connect pain with the food they're eating.
Right.
It's just counterintuitive. But you get some of these organic foods replacing, non-organic mm-hmm. foods. You take inflammatory foods out of your diet, and the pain condition really, settles down.
Right, right. Yep. Yeah, I know of a lady who has severe pain response to potatoes. Just debilitating,
In the joints?
Yeah, her joints, yeah, joint pain. And I know on the obvious, symptom side, that I know a number of people who are gluten sensitive, cannot eat any gluten in this country, but they go to Europe where all GMOs are banned. And they can eat pasta and pizza, and it doesn't bother them at all.
So
they actually have an allergic response to the genetically modified or high level of gluten that our flours have.
Yeah, I've been wondering about that. That's been our experience when traveling to Europe, where normally here we don't do well with wheat. It's not a full-blown celiac mm-hmm. condition that my wife and I experienced, but we don't really feel that great.
Uh-huh.
But going to Europe, sure enough, like you were saying,
right.
Have scones, have pastries, and really not have the kind of symptoms and side effects. And I really have wondered about that, because even organic flours here,
right.
I really don't do well with. And I wonder, is that, is it's supposed to be heirloom grains, it's supposed to be, but it's still somehow, affected by the hybridization over the course of the last 100 years?
That would be a good guess. I couldn't say for sure. I know that all organic isn't equal, so there might be some people who are using heirloom, seeds for their organic flour, but I don't know that everybody would be doing that.
So heirloom doesn't necessarily mean organic, or organic doesn't necessarily mean
heirloom.
No,
I don't. That's not a requirement. I don't think it can't be genetically modified, but it can be hybridized and still be organic. So we've been hybridizing for a long time to make the grains higher gluten content, higher production.
And the higher gluten content, does that make it more a stronger growing plant that's more resilient?
I don't know about that. I know of it as, for the baking end of it, that it makes the breads fluffier, it makes them more elastic so they hold together better, they don't crumble, so we get our really fluffy, mushy white bread. And that's where that, that hybridization is. The gluten that holds it together is the gluten that gives it the loft in the baking process. And so if you use like a spelt, which is an ancient grain, you'll get a much denser bread.
Have you found that people that actually are sensitive to wheat do better with spelts, or do they react just as much?
I don't have personal experience with people with that. We made the switch a long time ago to using spelt. And I think I saw a gradual improvement in the family, but it really took first going gluten-free for our family to really see that health improvement. But I don't know if that's true for everybody. Some people might do better just on the kumut or the spelt, which has a lower gluten level. So if they have a mild sensitivity, then that would be –
they probably notice some improvement.
Right.
So what are the spectrum of symptoms that you see, both in maybe in your own family, but also in people you're working with and hear about and your friends and network? What are the kinds of symptoms you're seeing with gluten sensitivity?
It's a huge variety, and that's one of the things that makes it hard to pinpoint it sometimes. And it's the same symptoms you would see with many other food sensitivities. But some of the more commonly known ones are joint pain, GI problems, either diarrhea or constipation, headache sometimes, stomach cramps, fatigue, and that's what I experienced, is I just had severe fatigue, and we couldn't figure out what was causing it, and finally that was the root problem under it all. We thought, you know, first I thought I had adrenal fatigue, and I did, but it wasn't the cause. It was a symptom of the gluten sensitivity. You can get the allergy dark bands under your eyes. I had two of my daughters that had really severe, you know, dark shadows under their eyes, and when they went gluten-free, those cleared up.
Yeah, for me,
I think my own
experience, and it was really surprising because I love bread. I've always enjoyed it. I used to make pizzas all the time, and when you know, I just decided to take wheat out for I think 6 weeks, and I noticed that my sleep improved amazingly.
Ah, right.
You know, I'd go lay down at night, and you know, I'd be tired, and then as soon as I lay down, my mind would just start to go nuts. And I'm like, what is going on? And
right.
I really had no idea, you know, what was causing that. But when I took the wheat out, it totally disappeared.
Right.
And of course, after that 6 weeks of taking it out, I'm like, well, maybe it was something else. Surely it wasn't the bread. But I remember the day I was at an Italian restaurant and I had this really great little, you know, I don't know what they call them, you know, just basically an Italian loaf of bread, and it was fresh baked, and I was like, oh, this is good. And only just a couple pieces, and man, my mind was going bonkers that night.
Right.
So it came back like a storm.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the side effects of our going gluten-free in our home, and we were looking at my health and some of our children's health, was Father Christopher used to snore really bad at nighttime and stop snoring.
Wow.
So it was inflaming his respiratory track. And sure enough, anytime he has something out or about, he'll snore that. And I'm like, what'd you eat today?
Busted up.
Exactly. That's what he told the kids. I can't get away with anything.
Oh, wow.
So that, yeah, another way. So it just creates inflammation and it all over the body, you know, and it really messes with the brain, you know, with
it's
our
irritation, anxiety probably would even be type maybe.
Anxiety behavior. One of our children, it causes really, a severe behavioral response, you know, just kind of out of control temper tantrum, you know, can't know, no boundaries, you know, so she just, everything, you know, just really affects her really, really strongly, when she has any gluten at all. And so it just, and it acts as, opiate on the brain. And so for some people, or, and I don't know maybe if it does for everybody, but for some people it just creates that really strong,
right,
response to it. And it was like an addiction for her. When we stopped eating it, she was just like always trying to grab bread everywhere, you know.
Right, so a little withdrawal phase.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a brief break here. We're speaking with Mary Sarah Stanton. She's a holistic health coach, and you're listening to The Bridge to Everywhere. So thanks for joining us here. We'll be back in just a minute.
Community radio is what you make it. If you want to be involved with Radio Free Palmer, contact us on the web, radiofreepalmer.org. We're looking for ideas, we're looking for volunteers, and we're looking for help. Thank you so much, and enjoy.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to The Bridge to Everywhere. I'm Kevin Middleton, and I'm speaking with Mary Sarah Stanton, holistic health coach. And before we get back into our conversation, I wanted to invite everyone to visit RadioFreePalmer.org, take a look at the membership levels, and jump in and be a part of this amazing station and this great work that's happening out of this studio. We wouldn't be here without it, and we're just having the time of our lives to be able to share this information and the talent in our community. So back to gluten, just a few things we were talking about. You know, I mean, everybody pretty much in our culture really grew up with bread. I mean, just about everybody. It's such a staple.
Yeah.
And so to take that out of one diet is a pretty big leap. But it has, I mean, you go anywhere and you say gluten-free this, gluten-free that. You go in the grocery store and you see there's a whole aisle of gluten-free. That does not necessarily mean healthy.
And no.
See, gluten-free peanut butter cookies, gluten-free brownies, or what have you.
Yes.
So could you say something about that? Just how do you approach the gluten-free life in a healthy way?
Well, that can be challenging. So for someone who's not used to cooking their own food, it takes a little bit of sleuthing about what's out there. And I think the hardest part is no matter how good a gluten-free product is, it never has the same taste or texture as something made from wheat flour. And so it partly just takes a commitment to, I need to do this for my health, you know, and so I'm going to have to find a way to begin to make that transition. There are healthier brands than others, and so that is something that I would help people determine, which of these have less sugars, less starches. When I was used to baking all my own bread using organic grains, and I went and looked at the stuff in the store, and I'm like, this isn't food.
Right.
You know? It's made out of a combination of unreadable words and starches. You know?
So maybe that's a really good place for people to start, right, is just to look at that ingredient list and see if there's actual food in there.
Right. Yeah. If it starts with sugar or if it starts with potato starch, probably not a good one to pick, you know. If it starts with, you know, brown rice, then that's a good start, you know.
When you work with clients, are you actually going to the grocery store with them, or do you just give them homework assignments?
I haven't yet, but it's definitely something that I'm considering adding to part of my program. So I meet with people on an ongoing basis, and so to consider that one of those sessions be going to the store with them and helping them look at, you know, what's available and where is it and what's better for us and not so good for us and stuff. And then I have, you know, so the best option is to be able to make your own gluten-free foods at home. And what I do a combination. I use a variety of gluten-free flours, and I have some great recipes for that I share with people. And, you know, some sources for getting, you know, some pastas and things like that. But also what I've discovered is we just don't eat as much. Yeah, we use more vegetables and less grains, for the carbohydrates, you know.
And do you find that has a big impact on your energy levels through the day?
Yes. Yeah. You know, I eat a lasagna made with, you know, even with gluten-free noodles, it still kind of leaves me heavy and tired, and I make it with zucchini strips instead, and I feel fabulous.
Wow. What a great idea. I mean, you get basically the same. I can imagine it.
It works fabulous.
Yeah, yeah.
Really fabulous. And you wind up with lots of veggies and, you know, it's just really healthy all around.
Got the cheese in there too,
yep.
Right? So.
Yep. Cheese and veggies and, you know, tomato sauce and meat if you eat meat and, you know, it's really good.
You know, I've seen some articles recently about gliadin, which is another protein apparently in wheat products that is found to be inflammatory for even people that might not test sensitive to gluten or have gluten, that there's actually this other protein. Have you come across that at all?
I haven't, actually. That's one I'll have to look into.
Yeah. And it's something, I can't remember the title of the book, but it's a medical doctor who's really, you know, banging the drum for this one. And he's, you know, doing the talk show circuits. He's promoting his book. It might be Wheat Belly. I think the book might be called.
Okay. I've heard about Wheat Belly, yes.
Yeah.
People really like it.
Yeah. And so anyway, it's just shedding more light to the kind of chronic illnesses and symptoms that people are experiencing, tying it back to wheat. And who would have ever known?
Right, yeah. Right. And, you know, people go, well, how can I possibly be allergic to wheat? We always have eaten wheat, for thousands of years. You know, I grew up eating wheat. Well, and that's exactly what causes some of it is we grew up eating wheat. And, you know, 100 years ago, we'd have a piece of bread with some cheese on it, you know, and it was a much lower gluten content, you know, wheat. You would have a higher concentration of the other nutrients, you know, to the protein in the wheat you were eating. But if you look at a plate today, we sit down to a bowl of pasta with a salad with croutons with French bread. Yeah, so we're eating wheat, we eat more wheat,
right.
You know, or we have pizza and cheese rolls. Yeah, or we have, you know, so it's just like, you know, we eat a much more amounts of it than we used to. We also went through the phase where it was very popular to introduce grains very young to children, when they still should have only been receiving breast milk. So under 6 months, the body is not at all ready to process or digest grains. And we were giving them, you know, baby cereals, rice cereals, wheat cereals, that they were eating at those very young ages. So that created an immune response.
And
those
pancakes.
Children, pancakes, your immune response in them that they grew up with and then passed down to their children. So those are a couple of the theories. And then the higher amounts of gluten that have caused this kind of epidemic of gluten sensitivity.
Got it. Well, Let's move on to the food pyramid that we learn in school, mm-hmm. which, you know, you've got your bread category, you've got your dairy category, you've got these, you know, is that in your studies and research with integrative nutrition, mm-hmm. Is that really accurate? Is that the best? I mean, we have our own opinions and our own training
right.
with Chinese medicine, but I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that.
No, it's not accurate. And sadly, a large amount of our nutrition advice that's given in this country really comes from the food companies. And so whoever is growing the most products and is, you know, spending the most money on advertising and, you know, the most support in different government legislature is getting the biggest section of the pyramid. and if you look at a traditional pyramid, you think about, you know, it doesn't have dairy under protein. It has dairy as a separate category. Well, dairy is really protein. So it should have, you know, carbohydrates, not grains. It should have carbohydrates, which are grains and vegetables. It should have protein, which is all kinds of protein, beans and meats and dairy and, you know, fish. And so those are really the food groups, you know, not specific pieces of those food groups. And so we have at Integrated Nutrition, actually, they've developed their own pyramid, a now plate, with, again, food, but in real food groups. And in the glass, we have water, not milk. and those other primary foods that I talked about, you know, the looking at that a healthful diet isn't just about the food we take in. That's not the only thing that nourishes us. And so we look at, you know, a healthy balance of, you know, we need those food groups. We need the carbohydrates. We need the proteins. We need the fats, and water. But there needs to be more of a balance to those. And that on the traditional pyramid, the grains are way too high. The sugars are too high. It says little, but it always shows all sorts of ways to have sugar.
Right.
And there's nothing about exercise. Oh, they think they finally have added an exercise, you know, a little guy running upstairs or something like that, you know. But that's only part of the picture, you know, that if we have an awful job, we're going to have a lot of stress. And if we have a lot of stress, we're going to have poor health. You know, if we have relationships that are bad, we're going to have a lot of stress and we're going to have poor health. And we're going to eat poorly because we're going to eat those comfort foods. If we're under stress, we're going to eat those comfort foods, even if we know that we don't want to.
So let's talk about that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
How for folks who, quote unquote, are emotional eaters,
mm-hmm.
how do you break that cycle? How do you...
There's a few ways. One is to look at what's behind the emotional eating, you know, so what are the causes of it, and to begin to look at resolving those issues. And sometimes that's something I can help with. Sometimes that's something that's beyond my scope of practice, and then to refer them to somebody that can help them, you know, resolve those issues. So that's the underlying piece to look at. And then to look at healthier ways to deal with those emotional, you know, eating habits. So, you know, maybe instead of having, you know, ice cream, we have frozen yogurt. It's a step, you know, and we just gradually make those steps to, or we have a piece of fruit, or we, you know, just begin to, where can they go? You know, what's the first step they can take? And then step by step, help them to begin to transition, one, to identify what's causing the emotional eating and work on that, and simultaneously to work on some more healthful and positive ways to deal with that, you know. And maybe instead of eating all, we go out for a run, get some fresh air, get some exercise, you know. and that helps the body feel better and helps burn off some of that energy.
That's really great. I mean, actually, what you said there is it kind of has you halt for a moment. You know,
mm-hmm.
that rather than just reacting immediately to the impulse to eat, to stop and then maybe do something different.
Right.
And in that, you're exercising a certain volition, a certain power,
right.
and redirecting.
Right. And we have to become aware in the first place that we're even emotionally eating.
Yeah.
Most of us aren't even aware of that in the first place. We just feel bad and we eat. We don't like how we feel inside, so we fix it by eating.
It's interesting, you know, because in a way, sometimes we'll have people describe emotional eating and they'll chuckle, you know, like, well, you know, I'm an emotional eater, and chuckle a little bit. And so there is this sort of awareness of what, you know, this is not really the right thing to be doing,
mm-hmm.
but yet I do it. And I like the idea of really pointing to that underlying, you know, what is the food filling that something else isn't,
right.
and taking a look at that. There's another thing that, I mean, for me, actually, just one thing I've discovered working with patients, if they have a sugar addiction mm-hmm. and to try to get off of sugar, is a Fuji apple is incredible. You know, it's a really good, full, you can't eat a Fuji apple and feel like you haven't gotten a sweet fix.
Yes.
And you'll feel great afterwards, and, you know, you could even, you know, beef it up with maybe some sliced bananas, a little bit of yogurt, and then you have some whole nutrition coming in.
Right, right.
And that's been really effective.
Yeah, and a really great compliment is to have a protein and a carbohydrate, whether in a vegetable or a grain, formed together. That really gives you that sustained energy also, and so that makes a great snack, you know, is to have a sweet fruit and some yogurt, or a sweet fruit and a piece of cheese, you know, or something like that. And that's a really good way to substitute and give you some good sustained energy simultaneously.
For sure.
Yeah.
You know, there's a myth out there that if I'm going to eat healthy, I'm going to be denying myself.
Uh-huh.
And I want you to speak about that a little bit, because I know it's not true, and you can eat amazingly healthy food and wonderful foods and feel terrific. And
right.
So that's a myth, and it's one that's you know, used a little too freely. And so I'm wondering if you could say about something about that, and then also in your work with clients, do you help them with recipes and really walk them through how to really create healthy food that's going to be delicious?
Yeah. So on the first hand, I've lost my train of thought.
Well, just, you know, kind of to move past the idea that healthy food tastes bad.
Yes, right. So, no, by far it does not taste bad at all. So far from the truth. But, yeah, we do. But our taste buds are trained to want the taste of the unhealthy foods, and that's part of the food company's, you know, agenda. They add all sorts of things to the foods that make them taste really good, that make them really addictive to the body, but they're not natural food tastes. And so it does take a little bit of reacclimating to the taste of real foods. And again, that comes through working out those, you know, helping them with really healthy, really delicious tasting recipes to try as their first try. So what's something that they're going to be really successful at? That's simple, that's going to taste really good, you know. And to help just agree and gradually make that transition, start by adding in, and this is my philosophy and from the school too, that we don't cut out bad stuff, we add in good stuff. And so as you add in the good foods, as you add in the Fuji apples, as you add in the fresh carrots, as you add in, you know, the lasagna made with maybe zucchini if wheat's a problem for you, that you don't need those other things anymore. It just kind of begins to push them out. And so it's not a negative experience. It's a positive experience,
mm-hmm.
you know, and make that transition. And, yeah, it's a different diet. You're not going to eat the same diet, but do you really want to keep eating the same diet that's making you sick, that's making you tired, that's making you overweight? You know? Because if you do, you're only going to get sicker and die, you know. And so there is a transition period of letting the body readjust to the taste of real foods. Yeah.
Do you generally have people, I guess, you know, on one hand, a person could go out and clear their whole pantry of all this junk,
mm-hmm.
and just so they're not tempted, is that, or do you say, well, let's, you know, phase in this gradually?
It's better to do it gradually.
Okay.
So when in working with clients, it's a gradual process of let's eat more vegetables, you know, so just start getting in the good stuff. Don't worry even about getting the bad stuff out yet. You know, drink more water, eat more vegetables, eat more greens, and help them in that, support them in that process. Then begin to talk about some of the foods if they're having problems with diabetes, then okay, let's see how can we get the bad sugars out and replace it with some more supportive, healthful sweets, you know. If they're having problems with gluten, can we begin to transition those foods out, you know? So take it step by step, you know, and each person has a unique needs and, you know, a scenario of their life. And so I work with each person individually. Where do they need to go? What do they need to work on first? You know, where do they need help? Do they need help with shopping? Because they haven't a clue where to even begin in the grocery store.
Right.
You know, all I buy is all those middle aisles that are in the freezer in the boxes.
Right.
You know? What do you mean greens? Where are those? So what do they need? You know, do they need, you know, if someone needs me to, I would come into their kitchen and help them begin to make that change. But I would do it gradually. I don't think it's a good idea to dump everything right first, because you're just going to go back to it. You know, if you go cold turkey and clear it all out and bring all this healthy food in, some of it's going to spoil, some of it's going to taste bad because you don't know how to fix it, and you're going to go back to what you know.
So set yourself up for success.
Yeah, yeah.
A big part of this, sounds like to me, is planning. You know, that in order for this kind of a change to happen, that you need to, first of all, think about the nutrition, to really want it, to want to nourish yourself and your family, and begin to think ahead of time. And also, so you're at work and you're stressed out, you've already thought it through, you're going to have these kinds of snacks that are healthy and wholesome, and don't reach for the sugar.
Right. Right. Yeah. Take something with you. You know, have it prepared and take it with you ahead of time, that you've got a good choice already. It takes planning. It takes support. You know, that's why we call ourselves coaches. You think about like a ball team, you know, the players do the work, but without the coach, there's no coordination. There's no improvement. There's no
accountability.
Right. And so having, having someone to help you plan where you're going. What are your goals and how do we get to those goals? You know, and then had to have the support in that process, you know.
How about when you have a family dynamic that's not supportive to these kinds of changes?
Mm-hmm.
And, do you have any thoughts or suggestions for folks where, you know, one person in the household is really geared up and wants to make these changes?
Mm-hmm.
How important is it to have the husband or the wife on board or the kids on board?
Well, it certainly makes a huge difference. I mean, if you have a husband that's supportive, if you have children that are willing, it's going to be a much, much easier process. And sometimes it's easy to get them on board. Sometimes it's harder. I have a client that I actually wound up meeting with her at her home, and her husband was present. And so we were talking about, you know, they're really big meat eaters. And it was like, okay, so how can we get you some healthier choices in meat? And talking about, you know, getting pastured, you know, grass-fed beef and pastured chickens and, organic. And he was online looking up resources of where to get these meats before the session was over.
Wow.
And so it was really, really cool to see him get on board like that, where he wasn't so interested in the very first place, you know. So that was really good, you know. And the other thing is just slowly. So the person who, if there's not a lot of support, then to support the person who wants to make the change. And so, make sure you make yourself a healthy lunch. You know, if you're going to work, you take what is good for you to work. You know, if it's the person who's in charge of the cooking in the home, to gradually make those changes little bit by little bit and just introduce, don't change everything dramatically, but add it as another option to the meal. Add, you know, or make a little bit healthier choice to a meal. And a lot of families will slowly begin to make that adjustment. Yeah. And just kind of de facto begin to make better choices.
Okay. Well, we've talked a lot about food and its role in really in health coaching, mm-hmm. and it's a huge one, I know.
Yes.
Are there some other areas that, you know, maybe talk a little bit about the other areas that you're helping folks work
right.
with?
Right. So the other areas are the primary foods I talked about, so exercise and relationship and career and spirituality. And actually that's where Father Christopher and I are working together, and he really focuses around kind of the relationship and spirituality and career issues, but I deal with them also in my practice. And that's why, at the center, we say that we care for you in soul and body. You get truly holistic care. You know, I look at kind of the physical aspects of nutrition and exercise, and he looks at the more, you know, spiritual and relational aspects of health. But they overlap, and I do all of those. So in those areas, asking them how they're going, you know, helping them, just talking about situations can really be very healing. So just give them a safe space to be able to talk about what's going on in their, you know, marriage, what's going on with their kids, what's going on, with their relationship with their mother, you know, just that ability just to have someone to caringly listen, is very healing. Mm-hmm. And then to, you know, ask them questions and support them in that path of where do they want to go with that? You know, what do they want to do about that, and how can we help with that? You know, I'm not a fitness trainer or a counselor or anything like that, so it's more just more supportive, you know, and encouraging, you know, in that those realms. Same thing with the exercise. You know, I can give them suggestions and tips and, you know, really support them in trying to make those changes. And that's so, so important. You know, our bodies are made to move. And if we're not moving, and I really prefer movement to exercise, it sounds, exercise can be very artificial.
Right.
And it's like, it really needs to be a natural part of your life. That's what it was in the past, and we live in an environment that doesn't support a natural day of movement anymore. But, you know, that is so key to health. That we're moving, you know, that we're going for a walk, that we're swimming, that we're biking, that we're dancing, something, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's just activating the circulatory system, and every function in the body is going to be made better,
right,
more vital by movement, and yet we're an increasingly more complacent culture, and so it seems like it's pretty essential.
Yeah, yeah, very, very much.
You know, underneath all of these sort of the impulse to exercise or to eat well,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's, like, if you come down to the sort of underlying motive, it seems like as a health coach that you have to start there. Is that true? Just like when somebody starts off, maybe getting clear about the motive and maybe flushing that out with folks so they're clear about why
right.
they're even taking on this change?
Well, and that's when I meet with them, I offer, you know, for most people, a free initial consultation. And in that process, we talk about, you know, what are their health concerns? What are their goals? What is their history? You know, and how can I work with them with that? You know, and that helps them begin to think about where are they at and how did they get where they are? And, you know, things even like our blood type and our ancestry play into what foods are good for us and what foods are not good for us. So many people don't even know what their blood type is, you know, and never considered that because I'm Asian or because I'm Russian, it makes a difference in how I eat, you know. So I do that, you know, and then I kind of approach it both ways. Work at, as we go along, what's underneath this? So ask them deeper questions as we develop a relationship, you know, what are those underlying causes? What's going on? But at the same time, also dealing with the immediate issue in front of me. So like with the emotional eating, you know, begin to look at what is behind the emotional eating. You know, what's the foundational piece of that? But to give them some healthier tools right away,
mm-hmm.
you know, to work with it.
So when you maybe walk us through a typical consultation and then what that would look like, you know, do you meet weekly for a while or do you, you know, just maybe
mm-hmm.
walk us through the process a little
okay.
bit.
So initial consultation is about an hour, people meet with me in my office and we talk about, you know, where they're from, what are their health goals, what are their concerns, you know, are they married, do they have children, do they have pets, what did they eat growing up, what are they eating these days, you know, so, and they get a questionnaire ahead of time to fill out as best they're able, and then we kind of flush it out as we talk. You know, what's their blood type, what's their ancestry, do they have any allergies, what kind of care they are already receiving, you know, so what have they learned and explored about themselves already, and, you know, what kind of exercises in their life. So just kind of get an overall picture of where are they right now.
Medical history and
mm-hmm.
all the...
Right. Well, not as detailed a medical history. So, you know, but major surgeries, major illnesses, but maybe not... It's not as detailed as you go
sure.
and they ask you all these many, many questions about the different types of illnesses.
Gotcha. Yeah.
It's a more general look at their life. You know, there's a lot more to it than just the medical history, you know. And then I look at, okay, so what have they talked about and what in here is stuff that I could help them and support them in, you know, and so then I let them know, okay, you know, I can help you, you know, reach your goal of losing some weight, of eating healthier, of exercising more, you know, of talking about and working on your relationship, you know, kind of that kind of stuff. And if that's interesting to them, then, sign them up for a program. And it's a 6-month program and we meet every other week. For an hour. And then I contact them in the in-between week and just see how things are going. And in each of those sessions, we work on their goals, and it can change through the program as they, you know, stuff gets resolved or they find new things they want to work on. And just really support them, you know, in achieving, you know, better health.
And there's clear, do you have markers, you know, that along the way, just, you know, health, you know, like landmarks of accomplishment or you set
well I certainly like, when we reach something, you know, make note of it when I see, you know, or if they're concerned, oh, I'm not making progress, oh look, you've done this and this and this, you know, and show them where they have come, you know. I take notes at every session. I give them recommendations of things to try in those in between weeks, and then check in with them on how those recommendations are going.
Great. And if in the course of doing that, you find that there are some deeper issues, maybe at a spiritual level, mm-hmm. or some, you know, or then would you be a separate consultation with Father Christopher? Or?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, yeah. If there's something that I really see that is beyond what I do and really more applicable to what he does, then I would suggest that they meet with him. And he does the same thing. He offers a free initial consultation to sit down and talk about those issues.
And that free initial consultation, is that that's not the full thing that you were just describing.
Mm-hmm.
That is.
Well, it's the health history that I was talking about.
Yeah.
Taking
so you'll spend
that
a full hour mm-hmm. complimentary
yeah.
with folks. Wow,
yeah.
that's
yeah.
extraordinary.
Yeah. Yep. To let them talk about their goals and see what we can do to help them. And then we also, at the center, we have monthly talks on health topics to support people in their journey.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, one of the things I was going to ask you is if you could share a few resources with folks that maybe want to learn a little bit more about healthy eating. Are there websites that you like to look at, you know, or for folks that are looking for weight loss or you know, where do you have additional things people can refer folks to?
A couple. So there's a brand new website called Wellness Today, which has some wonderful information and blogs on it around health and wellness. So that's wellnesstoday.com, I think. Not sure if it's .com
right.
or
yeah,
.org. So that's a great one. There's some really great cookbooks. Nourishing Traditions by Sally Fallon is a really, really good cookbook. And also Nourishing Meals, and I don't remember the author's name right offhand, but is a really good cookbook also.
Great, great. Well, we're coming down to the last seconds of the show. We're talking to Mary Sarah Stanton. She is a holistic health coach at the Center for the Living Soul, and that's centerforthelivingsoul.com. You can find her on Facebook. At Facebook, you can just search Center for the Living Soul. Now, your office is located off of Trunk Road, is
yep,
that right?
In the Colony Barns at the very end of Trunk Road. The two orange Colony Barns after you cross over the highway,
great.
Along with Heritage Birth Center.
Okay. Any last words you'd like to share?
Just that, you know, I really hope that people have found this beneficial and that if they can would like some help with better nutrition to give me a call.
Great, great. And your number?
315-2685.
Okay, great. Mary Sarah Stanton, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links and resources from our guests and show topics.